The Jason Rant Show.
Jason Rant hosts a radio show in Seattle, and he has, as always, the details for us exclusively.
Jason Rant, our Seattle guy, is with us now.
Jason Rant, always great to have you in focus. Thank you.
Hey, Jason, I think you're all right, and thanks for being on the show.
An update on what's happening in your Pacific Northwest.
Alarming new data out of Seattle and how long it's going to take for an officer to respond to a 911 call. We'll tell you what that number is and where the staffing finds itself. Sammy Byrd is running for governor. He's a Republican. He tells us, actually, he's been getting some good responses from Seattle. And we'll take you into the drama that's been unfolding with a homeless encampment in the city of Burien. Here's a little bit of a hint. The drama is going to get a little bit more intense over the course of the next few days. We'll tell you why this hour on the Jason Rant Show. So, let's dive in.
The monologue.
Oh, the irony of two cities getting together and what is some, I guess, unofficial partnership in tackling homelessness when neither city knows what it is it's doing. I'm talking, of course, Seattle and Portland. In the city of Portland, the council there is dealing with a proposal that would ban camping for most of the overnight into the early morning on city sidewalks and streets and in parks, etc. And of course, the activists in Portland are out for blood. They're pushing back. You've got the business community saying, we need this, we want this, we have to have this. It's killing our businesses. People feel unsafe. They don't want to come in. You've got people who live in the area who aren't part of the activist community saying the exact same thing. And when you've got a mayor like Ted Wheeler, who's very, very, very far to the left, who is actually calling for this proposal and pushing it forward and being its cheerleader, it tells you how bad it's gotten.
It's also about livability, cleaning up the sidewalks, cleaning up the litter, abating the graffiti, and returning those parts of our city to their prior luster.
Now, remember, he is a reason why it's gotten so bad in Portland. He is a big reason why. He's not the only reason. An out-of-control city council, their commissioners. Now, remember, their commissioners have gone through a little bit of a change. For example, Joanne Hardesty, who was their version of Shama Sawant, the most extreme commissioner on their council, she's out of a job. In large part because of how out of control the city's homelessness crisis and crime crisis have gotten. But there was a moment in an interview with Como TV, which this whole story was framed around whether or not Seattle would consider doing the same kind of ban, which will never, ever, ever happen. Not with this council. Maybe once the elections are over, maybe. Maybe, maybe, maybe. But right now, of course not. But I thought that this was kind of interesting. Not just the framing, but when the mayor of Portland spoke about working with the city of Seattle.
My staff has been up to Seattle to visit with them and look at some of the work that Seattle's doing, and vice versa. We can learn from each other. We shouldn't have to act in isolation.
Got it. What are we learning from each other? I'm just kind of curious. Aren't you kind of curious? What exactly are we learning from each other? What is it that you're doing that's working? Because you're at an emergency level, a crisis level, the same way Seattle is. Both cities have been hesitant to commit to sweeps because of the activists in the community and, frankly, on the council. And at a time in the mayor's office, I think our mayor right now in Seattle, Bruce Harrell, is not anti-sweep. I think he is a believer in it. He just won't move forward fully because he fears the political consequences of it. He doesn't want the headache, and I'm imagining he's going to run for re-election at some point. He doesn't want to have to compete with that. But you've got two cities that have no clue what it is they're doing when it comes to homelessness, trying to, quote unquote, work together. It's very odd that we would be, quote unquote, working together. Now, in Portland, the city council is going to vote on this, or at least they expect to vote on the policy next Wednesday, June 7th. And it's coming at a time, and we did this story about 3 weeks ago, where at the state level in Oregon, the Democrats are looking to legalize camping everywhere. In fact, it would cause a homeless person, if you quote unquote harass them to move, which is simply just asking them to move, they can get a $1,000 fine from the individual or the agency that made the harassing request. They would earn that money. So that's actually being discussed and debated at the state level, which if that were to happen, and honestly, I don't know whether or not it's going to happen. it seems like it would be unlikely, but again, it is Oregon. That would overrule anything on the city level that's being discussed. Then in this Como piece, they spoke with Teresa Mosqueda, the Seattle City Councilwoman who is running to become the King County Council member in her district. And I thought also this was curious.
I think in the city of Seattle are proud to be national leaders when it comes to housing.
Okay, so apparently we are national leaders when it comes to housing. All we've heard for the last several years is that we are in the middle of a housing crisis, a housing affordability crisis. So how exactly in the world are we leaders in the nation?
I think in the city of Seattle are proud to be national leaders when it comes to housing.
How are we national leaders? What are we doing? Seriously, what are we doing? Because rents are going up again. So what exactly are we doing? In between you telling us that we're at crisis levels from a housing affordability perspective? So we're not. We're not leading anything. We're leading from behind, I guess. Now this.
The interview.
Well, it's become clear that unfortunately in the city of Seattle, the staffing crisis within the SPD is not getting any better. The chances of success or hitting any of the significant goals that were set by the mayor, they definitely will not be hit this year. And that means longer wait times when you call 911. Joining me on the line is the president of the Seattle Police Officers Guild, Officer Mike Solon. Welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon, Jason. Thanks for having me.
How bad are the response times? There's new data.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. It's unacceptable. And tragically, it's a result of us not having enough cops to protect the public. And we have more victims of crime. Homicides are up. And we cover this on a weekly basis on SPOG's social media. You can find us on Twitter at SPOG1952. We release what we call the Public Safety Index, the numbers that track the true numbers, which the department and the city are not putting out as accurately as they should. And we do. And right now we're at 29 homicides.
Yep.
And the story is priority one response times, which is the most emergent situation that you want immediate police intervention to help you, are through the roof. And it's largely because we don't have a labor contract, Jason. 2.5 years in, we're not valuing the remaining officers that still work for the city to retain them. And you can do that by getting a labor contract. And we can't recruit anybody because of that problem.
Yeah. And just to give some context to the numbers, it obviously it's a little bit different precinct by precinct. But when you look at the East Precinct, which is the one across the street from the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone back in the day, back in 2020 for a priority one call, it used to be 6 minutes and 63 seconds on average. And now it's over 9.5 minutes, which, again, every second counts when we're dealing with a crisis in the moment that demands immediate attention. When you look at priority three calls, the kinds that people are putting in every single day for break-ins and whatnot, it went from over 1 hour and 4 minutes to, wow, almost 2 hours.
Yeah, that's a long time, and it's unacceptable. And I like the way you put it, when seconds count. The problem is the only way that those two link and where you can try to wrap your head around it, why is that occurring? Is because we don't have enough cops.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, when we talk about augmentation, which is getting other officers that are off shift to do another shift on overtime just to get us to some reasonable minimum safe staffing level, the East Precinct is the most difficult precinct to get officers to volunteer to work extra overtime to fill a patrol shift. So, I mean, this problem is not going to go away. And sadly, it's only going to get worse. And the only way that we can stop it from getting worse is to, number one, get political support from our elected leaders saying, hey, we're valued. And then get us a labor contract. And like I said, I'll keep on hammering it while I'm talking to you. It's 2.5 years expired. We have more. We have about roughly 200 people eligible to retire right now. And we're still losing more than we are gaining people in this profession, particularly in Seattle. It's a huge, major public safety crisis.
I haven't seen the separations for the last month. We should get them within the next couple days or so over the weekend. But last month, based on the numbers, I think the best case scenario was that you might be able to get a net gain of five officers, maybe seven officers at the end of the year. Do you think even that very weak number is possible?
No, I don't. I don't think we're going to get enough people this year. I mean, year to date, we've already lost 45. This was 2 days ago. Those are our numbers from 2 days ago. We've lost 45 people. And then we're going to see a lot more at the end of this month due to how June plays out with the pension and retirement. And out of the people that they have hired, which is obviously less than 45, how many of those are actually going to get through the academy and get through the secondary training when they get to the department if they can pass field training? And what we're witnessing is we're not seeing a positive result of people remaining in the job once they get it.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I've been hearing from a lot of folks is that the recruitment that is happening, you're getting folks who otherwise would not be qualified to become an officer or would not necessarily be given as many chances for added training. That once you go through the academy, you are put with, you know, a senior officer out on the streets. I think it's about a month-ish of training out on the streets, but they're going longer than that because the folks who are passing through the academy just aren't yet ready.
Yeah, that's what they're seeing is like the candidate pool is not as robust as it was in the past. I think you will see an improvement on that level in terms of how competitive hiring lists are when the economy gets worse in upcoming recession and or people argue that we're in one right now, because people flock to public sector jobs because it's deemed a safe government job. Therefore, you have some economic security. But we're witnessing a bit of a struggle bus when it comes to people staying in the job because they're just not qualified or grasping what the job truly requires. And I'm worried, I've always said this in the hiring practices, are we lowering standards just to put a human in the uniform? And, you know, we saw how that played out in Memphis a few months ago. And God forbid that doesn't happen here. This is a serious problem that we're facing. We're trying to solve it. And truly, the only way, I'll echo it again, you got to give us a labor contract and value your employees. And then we can talk about improving, getting enough people to fill the uniform to get that priority one and other priority call time numbers down.
Not to get too much in the weeds, though, wouldn't you be better off waiting for a contract until a new council is in place? Hopefully one that might be a little bit more friendly to police officers. Now, I went through all the data. We talked about it earlier in the week. There are a shocking number of candidates who have stepped forward who are pretty much anti-police. They don't believe in staffing the police department to its goals. Some are flat out still pushing for defunding. I don't know how many of those will be considered serious contenders, but obviously the more crazies you got, the higher the likelihood is that they go into the general. Where do you think things would stand if you just maybe waited?
Well, I'm an optimist, and I can tell you right now, I can still work with this current council to get a deal done. It's going to be up to them, right? And it is up to them. We've been really reasonable at the table to try to get something accomplished, just to, not to sound dramatic, but to save this city from a public safety collapse.
Yeah.
And we've made moves. The ball is in their court on several fronts. There is a window here to get something done, but to your point, could we wait until next council? Sure. Well, we'll work with anybody if they become reasonable. And we've been extremely reasonable despite some of the public overtures saying otherwise. But we can get something done now, Jason. And the more time that drags on, the more cops will lose. the less people will have the ability to recruit because, number one, they see that the political culture is still toxic. We're not supported.
Yeah.
And then if you combine that with not having a labor contract that's reasonable, those 911 priority response times are going to get even worse. That's just basic common sense.
Yeah. We know what that will lead to, even worse crime. That's the unfortunate reality. We've been talking with the president of the Seattle Police Officers Guild, Officer Mike Solon. He's also the host of the podcast Hold the Line with Mike Solon. You can get it at seattlepoliceofficers.com. Thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate the plug, and I appreciate what you're doing for this city to try to protect it in the public safety crisis we find ourselves in. Good work, Jason.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. Now this.
The interview.
With yesterday's announcement of yet another candidate jumping into the race for governor here in Washington State, things are going to start heating up. We'll be checking in with candidates on the Republican side throughout the entirety of the race. Joining me on the line is Semi Byrd, who's running for governor. Welcome back to the show.
Jason's good to be back with you. Thank you.
Things are being done a little bit different this year from the Republican side, in which there's going to be a convention and folks actually get to vote on who the party will be endorsing. It doesn't necessarily mean that that person will actually win, but it does change things. Is that a positive or a negative in your view?
You know, conceptually, it's a positive because we need to stop dividing the votes. You know, I jumped in the race in November, as you know, November 11th of last year, and we've been raising money. We've been all over the state. We are gaining momentum. And so why would people keep jumping in after that? Well, again, this is a question for the voters. And so conceptually, it's a good idea. However, I think waiting until April of 2024 is a bad idea. It should be sooner. We need momentum. We need support. We need resources as soon as possible. So we're running our own strategy. We're getting out there. We're gaining momentum. We've raised more small dollar donations than any other campaign running right now outside of the Democrat Party.
So when should it be held? I know you're saying sooner, but what does that mean?
No, absolutely. And so when we talk about the elections and why Republicans continue to lose year after year, it's a lack of strategy, planning, mm-hmm. and execution. So how about the year before? How about 6 months before, where we actually coalesce around one candidate? We leverage those resources so that a candidate has a more viable chance of winning because they are actually getting the resources they need for advertising, media, etc. So I would say, if I was to give a date, let's shoot for December of 2023 instead of April of 2024.
How concerned are you that there will be more names coming up and making announcements that they're running on the Republican side?
Well, the good news is I'm not really concerned at all because we have an excellent strategy. We are building such momentum that folks are really excited about our campaign. So we're working our strategy and we're going to win the primary. But, you know, I'd like to control the things I can actually control, mm-hmm. and not focus on things that I can't control. So we're focusing on that, getting out there, traveling the entire state every single day. I'm on the road right now in Seattle. So we're full court press until now, from now until November 2024.
You have to get the thinking is about 40% of the King County vote to have a shot of winning any statewide election, certainly one like governor. What is the plan
Absolutely.
To say that, hey, I'm not a right-wing Eastern Washington, Central Washington-style candidate. I can't appeal to you guys in King County, in particular Seattle.
You know, brother, you probably know my background better than most. You know, I'm literally the kid born in the ghetto of East Oakland, California, without civil rights, to a single woman with seven children. My mother moved me to Seattle when I was 7 years old. I was raised in Seattle. I dropped out of high school in Seattle to enlist in the military from Seattle, and I came back home to Seattle, and then later I moved to Eastern Washington. So I understand what it's like coming up poor, living in poverty, single woman household, single parent household. We are in Seattle several days a week, every single week, and we're going to be there. Seattle, King County, Pierce County, we are getting out to communities, minority communities, right? Everyone's voice matters. And so we're going to those voices. We have a huge team on the ground right now, and we're bringing our tactical strategy to every citizen that we can reach. So we're not going to endorse, and we started months ago, my friend.
What is the reaction from various communities out there outside of like the hardcore progressive slash socialist Capitol Hill folks? Like when you go into South Seattle, when you go into North Seattle, when you go out into, you know, a Federal Way or a Kent, what are you hearing?
Jason, thank you for that question. So let me just say very clearly, very warm welcome. And here's the deal. A black businessman or woman versus a white businessman or woman, it doesn't matter in terms of they don't want overregulation, overtaxation with zero representation. They want support. They want the government to get out of their way and give them an opportunity to find the American dream. They are very supportive because we are literally focusing on the issues, not name calling, not labeling, and not dividing, but focusing on the issues and bringing real solutions to create value for all citizens of our state. And the other thing, you know, I said the other day, I don't believe in ghettos. What I meant by that is I know they exist, but in the 21st century society, every single citizen, regardless of their social economic status, deserves safe streets. They deserve quality in education. They deserve opportunities to grow. They deserve an opportunity for trades and certifications so that they can have the freedom of a good paying job. So no, the solutions that we're bringing is resonating against across all demographics, against all social classes. And we are giving voice to the folks who felt forgotten for too many years.
There you go. The website is birdforgovernor.com. You can learn more about his platform. And as importantly, you can learn how to donate money to the campaign if you feel so moved, because this is going to be an expensive one. No matter what, it'll be expensive, and he's going to need your support. Birdforgovernor.com. It's all spelled out. Bird, F-O-R, governor.com. Semi Bird, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you, my brother. Take care, and God bless you guys.
Thank you so much. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rant.
And the rise of soft on crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rant, is on that.
And you keep on bringing these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
The homeless encampment that has been causing quite a number of problems in Burien for businesses, one that previously existed at City Hall, then moved. County has been unwilling to do anything, so a group of folks with Burien Cares, a nonprofit group that's actually the leasers of the land in which this encampment is on, decided to take action yesterday. We brought you that story, but there are still some questions. Stephanie Mora is a Burien City Council member, and she joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, Jason.
You've been one of the leading voices in actually pointing out that this is a problem that needs to be taken care of. What was the role that the city held in clearing this encampment yesterday?
Well, they were really there just to take the trash, any debris that was left, large items. But they didn't play a role in telling people to move. They were just there really to pick up the trash.
How'd they know that it was happening?
I believe CARES let them know, and they had posted signs, I believe, about a week ago before this happened.
Yeah, and the reason why I asked that, there is, I guess, the new controversy is whether or not the city was behind this, because apparently they didn't give the folks who were living in this encampment a place to go. So what is your response to some of those complaints? And again, it's coming from a very small group of activists.
Yeah, we actually had the group of volunteers that were helping out Burien Cares. They are specialists in dealing with people that are homeless and need housing or help of some sort. And they actually did. They were there the night before the sweep happened, and they offered all 42 campers a place to go. There were, I think, two that went into detox. They had offered them low barrier housing. Some went into a shelter. And there were supposed to be six that were going to go into detox yesterday as well. But unfortunately, that didn't go the way as planned. There was a planning commission that was there, and he kind of told everyone, hey, you can actually go to this plot of land instead because it's not actually a park. And so the six people that were supposed to go into services yesterday ended up turning it down and didn't go with the volunteers and just ended up moving to a different campsite. So now we're dealing with a new encampment.
Of course. And doesn't that tell you so much about the general strategy when dealing with the homeless, this idea that unless you really get a little heavy-handed and pushing people into the services they desperately need, they're just going to say no. They just say, okay, no, I'm going to move somewhere else.
Exactly. And that's it's sickening to me, for me to see that and see it go down and hearing all the stories. There was actually a teenage girl who was at the encampment, and we found out she was a teenage girl, and the volunteers were able to reconnect her with her dad because I guess she had been missing for a while. So that was at least like a good end way to end things. But just that being allowed is sickening to me. Where does our responsibility end as a society? If we are giving these people a place to go, we're offering them services, we're offering them food, we're offering them shelter, housing, detox services. But if they're saying no, well, where does our responsibility end?
Yeah, and what's your level of frustration with the King County Regional Homelessness Authority that they've basically said, yeah, we're not going to do anything?
Exactly. It's been very frustrating trying to deal with them, even talk to them to see if they can come out and help. We've had lead and reach working with the encampment when it first was at City Hall. And I think they were able to get about seven people moved through a course. It was over a year that this encampment was at City Hall, and they were able to get about seven people moved during that entire time. And we have all of a sudden a group of volunteers that came out one night before the sweep at City Hall happened. They were there about a week before. Mm-hmm. And they were able to get more people placed into housing and placed into services and shelters than our own paid King County staff. And that was shocking to me to hear and see that myself.
Given that, do you think the King County Regional Homelessness Authority should exist? Should it be left up to you? I imagine you would do better with the money that ends up going into the KCRHA.
Honestly, I'm not for organizations that are ran by the government. I feel like the government does a really crappy job of managing funds. And when they are left with no other way of dealing with something, they end up asking for more money, more taxes. Let's increase this and that because we need to fund this more. And to me, all I've seen is a big failure on our government's part. And I've seen more action and more, I guess, lives turned around by volunteers mm-hmm. doing the work themselves. And that's kind of what I want to see more of, less government money thrown into what is definitely not working, and more community volunteers getting together and saying, I see that you need help. I'm going to be here every day offering you a place to go. I'm going to be here every day praying yep. over you and getting you into some sort of service. I've seen more lives turned around just within about 2 weeks when that encampment was being moved than an entire year with King County.
That's the funny part. Like, we know what works, right? I mean, exactly. This is not a shock to any of us who follow the nonprofits that are out there that aren't part of the homeless industrial complex, which, you know, God bless the folks at some of these organizations, including the King County Regional Homelessness Authority, but they continue to keep their six-figure jobs. And yes, they're making exactly. six figures. When homelessness stays as bad as it is or gets worse, that's exactly. the reality. And when you're talking about these nonprofit leaders, the ones who are sometimes just literally volunteering their time, they yeah. actually get results because they're motivated. It might be subconscious what's going on with the what I deem the homelessness industrial complex, but that's the reality.
Yeah, exactly. We actually have a building here in Burien being built right now that is called a DESC. I'm not too thrilled to see it. And all I've heard is finally these homeless people are going to have a place to go. They're going to have a house to go into. And I'm thinking, great, if that works the way it's like intended to work, then that's wonderful. But all I've seen is people using drugs, drinking alcohol. Mm-hmm. They think that they're getting help, and all of a sudden they leave the environment that they're doing these drugs and drinking, getting high every night. And then they come back to it and they just start the cycle again. So I'm like, BESE is, I'm sure, well intended, but out in practice is not. It has not gone well.
Yeah, and harm reduction strategies and housing first, I'm sorry, does not work. I wish it did.
It did.
Yeah, if it worked, we wouldn't have the crisis that we have. By the way, we're talking with Burien Councilmember Stephanie Mora. At the same time, there seems to be an interesting dynamic going on within the council. I think it's been a little less contentious than maybe it has been in the past. You guys got rid of Crystal Marks, who is a crazy person. And she's running again for re-election. You've got one of her allies, Sydney Moore, who's a colleague of yours on the council, basically takes similar positions when it comes to these issues. How much of the politics are getting in the way of a solution just from the city level?
Well, actually, I just wanted to correct something that you said, which was that she's running for re-election. So to be clear, she's not on the council right now.
Correct. Yeah.
She
used to be. She got lost. Yeah.
To me.
Yep.
So I'm the one that took that seat.
That's why we like you so much, Stephanie. That's why we're fans of yours. But yes, correct. She's technically not running for re-election. She used to be on the council. She lost. Now she's running again.
Exactly. And I'm not too thrilled about it, just because of everything that I've seen the council before my time. I would just see arguments back and forth, mm-hmm. and nothing was getting done. It was just a lot of, we're going to do this and this and that. And it was, I'm going to shove it down your throat, essentially. And I feel like now we are at least able to talk things over. Generally, I don't like to talk during the council. I will give my 2 seconds of why I'm not going to vote for something or why I am. And we kind of leave it at that. And I'm not excited to have people back on the council that are not willing to actually talk things out and just shove ideas down your throat. I would prefer a council that can actually talk things over and mm-hmm. figure out a way to kind of get into the middle ground. And I actually called one of our council members, Sydney Moore, because we don't agree on hardly anything. There's very few things that we agree on, but I actually thanked her that we at least can talk to each other before a council meeting, and we're able to kind of figure out, can we agree on one thing from this? And I told her I have respect for her, even though I don't agree with some of the views she holds. I still have respect for her because she's still able to call me before a council meeting and we talk things out.
And that's a positive, because you know what?
Yeah.
Every council seems to have their own version of Shama Sawant from Seattle, who's just a toxic person who ruins things for everyone. And to your point, yeah, you disagree with Councilmember Moore probably more often than not. But when you take out the toxic element in Crystal Marks, former council member, bam, all of a sudden things become a little less contentious, right? Just a little bit
exactly.
more cooperative. And I think that's awesome. And that's a credit to the work that not just you are doing, but also Councilmember Moore. We have been talking with Burien Councilmember Stephanie Mora. Thank you so much for stopping by and giving us some details. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. And I also did just want to mention, give a quick update about the encampment that we have right now at Darty Harper.
Mm-hmm.
I actually spoke with the city manager last night, and it turns out that the area that the people are camping on is considered a park. I know originally a few hours before the encampment turned to 14 tents, the police said that they weren't able to remove anyone there because the park that they are on is considered a right-of-way or easement and mm-hmm. not the actual park. It's just next to it. But within further investigation, turned out that it is a park, so they will be putting notices up that everyone has to be gone within 72 hours. So I'm very happy about that.
Yeah, there you go. More drama coming to the city of Burien and cleaning up the homelessness crisis. Councilmember, thank you so much. Wish you the best of luck.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You as well. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rants. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rants is in focus now.
Jason Rants, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
So it's June 2nd today. And as we mentioned yesterday, June 1st is the start of the month-long LGBT Pride celebration. And it's a month that I have significantly mixed feelings for, given the fact that it's become incredibly political. And I do not share the politics of a lot of the folks who put on various events the language that comes out of the movement I find to be pretty delusional. Again, mostly because I'm viewing it through the political lens that they're asking me to view it through, but because it's just not accurate. It's just not accurate. Yesterday, you had in Olympia the ceremony to put up the pride flag, and you had a whole bunch of folks showing up, like Jay Inslee, and of course he's doing it because he wants you to know that he supports the LGBT community. He doesn't have to even do anything. He just wants you to know that he supports it. It is nauseating the way that politicians and, frankly, corporations and government agencies, et cetera, act during Pride. But yesterday there was also one of the events to raise the flag at City Hall in Seattle. And they did a press conference beforehand, and you had Bruce Harrell out there talking about how, you know, not in my Seattle, we'll never ban books and keep trans people from getting the health care that they deserve. All those kinds, again, of political talking points. But there is a member of the LGBTQ Commission for Seattle. I believe she is the chair, maybe the co-chair. Her name is Lillian Williamson. And she made a comment that I don't think should go unresponded to.
And this isn't something that's just happening in Florida or Texas or Idaho. Our communities are still under threat in Washington and in Seattle. It is incredibly important that we do not become complacent as a community and as a city.
She is making up a fight that does not exist, and she's asking people to take on a fight that does not exist. Now, of course, there's the false equivalency between what she says is happening and what is, in fact, happening. You are not under threat as a, for example, transgender person if a school is not allowed to teach a, you know, 7-year-old that there are 14,000 different genders and the kid can pick whichever one he or she or they or Z or tree decides to pick. That's not an attack against the transgender community. Every single person today who is transgender or gay or lesbian or whatever you identify as, every single person right this moment has it better today than they had it yesterday, that they had it last month, that they had it 10 years ago, that they had it a decade and a half ago, that 2 decades, a century ago. Okay? At the end of the day, we have more rights for not just gender minorities, but racial minorities, religious minorities, folks who are disabled, folks who are, insert whatever new quote-unquote marginalized community you would like to talk about, all have more rights now than they've ever had in the history of this country. And yet we're supposed to believe that they're under assault because we can't go in front of a kid and promote puberty blockers in certain states. Or we will ban doctors from performing surgical interventions on children, on 14-year-olds. That is not a threat. Simply getting in the way of a political agenda of any group is not a quote-unquote threat to one's safety. And that's really what we're talking about here. That's what Lillian's talking about. It's not just happening in, what would she say, Idaho, Texas, and Florida. It's happening here in Seattle, in Washington. Really? Where? I'd like to know where. Tell me where that threat is coming from. Y'all just passed a bill, Senate Bill 5599. We talked a little bit about it yesterday again. That allows a kid to run away from home purely to get quote-unquote gender-affirming care, and the state is barred from telling the parent where the kid is, and the kid can go ahead and get that health care, quote-unquote, without parental consent. Where exactly is there a threat, and what is that threat? Usually, in places where there is a significant threat or even a minor threat, you are not going to have a ceremony in which you fly the gay pride flag, and not even the normal one, but the new one that adds BLM to it, one that is hyper-focused on transgender issues, which, by the way, isn't a sexual orientation. Gay isn't a gender identity. It's a sexual orientation. Transgender is not a sexual orientation. It's a gender identity. BLM has nothing to do with this. But, of course, you have to tip your hat to the quote-unquote BIPOC community in a post-BLM world. they tell you that a threat exists when it doesn't, because it helps, number one, create fear, create victims, and then gives them something to politically strive for, and they can bring you in. Now, are there threats on an individual level or like a hyper-local level? I guess, in that, I mean, there's always a bad guy who is, in fact, a bigot or dangerous. That's the case for every group, including white people. I know that folks on the left don't want to acknowledge that, even though there was an attack. I think it was a murder 2 weeks ago where two white guys were targeted because they were white. But the media didn't really cover that all that much, did they? In fact, I don't remember anyone outside of just some local coverage that I happened to see on Twitter cover it. Didn't get much at all. Now, is there going to be the threat against an individual trans person or gay person or bi person that will happen in June? Yes, because it happened last month and it'll happen next month. The same way, that same threat is there for me as a Jew. But that does not mean that an entire community is under assault, that there is a threat. It doesn't mean that at all. And for them to pretend, them being not just this LGBT commissioner, but the mayor, the governor, Democrats who are basically telling you that this threat exists when it doesn't, they're doing that to the disservice of a community that just wants to live life, live their own life. Now, there's some activists who want to push stuff on children. That's wrong. We will, of course, push back. And there are a lot more people within the gay community that are uncomfortable with the trans issues being pushed on kids. Some will speak out. Others won't, because they're scared of how they will be treated by the community. But there are growing voices within the LGBTQ community calling this stuff out. There are a lot of folks who are calling this stuff out now. It's still seen as a quote-unquote culture war. It's still seen as right versus left. I don't think this should be a right versus left issue. This is just about right versus wrong, appropriate versus inappropriate. We're talking about children. I haven't heard a threat of withholding certain health care, quote-unquote, from adults. If you want to go down a path that involves surgical intervention, that is your right. You can do that everywhere. We're talking about children. So let's not conflate that with an actual threat, because there is no threat. Not to the extent that you're explaining it as. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.